Gildan Media, a division of Recorded Books, presents Joan Gary's Guide to Nonprofit Leadership, Second Edition, by Joan Gary. Narrated by Joan Gary. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you may hear references to figures and tables present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Limit of Liability, Disclaimer of Warranty. While the publisher and author have used their best efforts in preparing this book, they make no representations or warranties with respect to the accuracy or completeness of the contents of this book and specifically disclaim any implied warranties of merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose. No warranty may be created or extended by sales representatives or written sales materials. The advice and strategies contained herein may not be suitable for your situation. You should consult with a professional where appropriate. Neither the publisher nor author shall be liable for any loss of profit or any other commercial damages, including but not limited to special, incidental, consequential, or other damages. Preface to the Second Edition. March 2017. I stood on a chair, I'm short, to offer remarks to clients, friends, family, and colleagues to celebrate the publication of my first book. Not gonna lie, it was exciting. A book. People saw me as this expert, someone who could help them figure out the gnarly knots that stood between them and the pursuit of their nonprofit mission. Little did I know then what an imposter I was. Well, maybe that is overstating a bit, but I had no idea how much more there was to know, how many more leaders there were to meet and hear from, and as a result, how much more advice there was to share with you that could be helpful. In this second edition, I add two major stories and a big dose of hope in a world that is more than just a little hungry for it. Story number one. In 2015, I came to understand just how many small nonprofits there were. As the popularity of my blog and podcast grew, now reaching folks from 150 countries around the world, I became something of a Dear Abby. And this Abby became totally overwhelmed with dozens of emails weekly from folks with challenges galore. While they often seemed insurmountable to the writer, I felt like I could help. I had advice for them, resources, and I could give them the pat on the back they desperately needed. But I couldn't keep up. And as a pleaser personality, leaving these folks hanging was not okay by me. Some research quickly unearthed the reason for the flood of emails. Nearly 70% of all nonprofits have budgets under $500,000. And how much do you think these groups budget for professional development? You guessed it, zero. Armed with all those emails and a digital marketing partner, I launched the Nonprofit Leadership Lab just 2 months after the publication of the first edition of this book. The Nonprofit Leadership Lab provides content and community for board and staff leaders of small nonprofits and is the best online resource of its kind. Since its launch, we have supported over 5,000 leaders, both board and staff. I feel a great sense of pride that we have been able to help so many folks develop new skills, transform their boards, write kick-ass grant proposals, and feel a sense of community with thousands in the U.S. and around the world. But it is what these leaders have taught me that is the main reason I wanted to write this second edition. Two-thirds of the sector stares at cash flow and yet is chock-full of passionate and remarkable founders for whom building and growing an organization is simply not the best and highest use of their magic powers. Hundreds of thousands of nonprofits build their boards the best way they know how, and board members are painfully unclear on the significant leading role they play in their organization's success. Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance, Scribner, is a first-rate look into the tough stuff people are made of, the role perseverance plays in who we can become. When I spend an hour engaging with our members, that is always the first word that comes to mind, grit. And it compels me to be even more of an advocate and champion for these leaders. And so a deep dive into small nonprofits, how to be an effective one, and what all nonprofits have to learn from the grit and determination of the small nonprofit are additional areas of focus in this edition. Story number two. Actually, it's many stories. Stories that upset me, stories that anger me, and stories that call me to action to use my platform to work to make things different. These stories are all about the power and responsibilities of boards to fully lead and partner with their organizations to move them from messy to thriving. Our sector does a downright poor job recruiting board members, educating them about what the job really is, and holding them accountable. In a monthly column for the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I spoke the truth about boards' abuse of power, that this may just be responsible for more great staff leader attrition than any other factor. The engagement in that piece was off the charts on every one of my social media platforms. Some folks even sent me videos because someone had asked that I see and hear them. Since I wrote the first edition of this book, Boards' Abuse of Power is a recurring theme I hear from members of my leadership lab and from the dozens of my coaching and strategy clients. This issue was prominent for me in 2016 and led me to write Chapter 3, which reframes nonprofit leadership as co-pilots flying a twin-engine jet. Today, I feel a greater sense of urgency as these stories continue to come my way. A lack of understanding of board service is the one thing that most often thwarts the success of a nonprofit organization's efforts to do the good work that is so badly needed. And this is as true of nonprofits with multi-million dollar budgets as it is of the hundreds of thousands of those organizations who struggle to hit $500,000 in revenue. I hope that my new chapter about why boards matter will be a catalyst in a broad and actionable conversation about how to make real and lasting change in this area. Those two stories represent my why about this second edition. Shall we talk about the why now? Since the first edition of this book was published in 2017, we have seen the development of a mindset that is about drawing lines in the sand and building walls, literally and figuratively. We have become a society that is focused on what divides us rather than what unites us. The situation is ugly. People on both sides of the aisle are angry. It seems hopeless. This divisive society will not magically disappear anytime soon. Hardly. And I guarantee you that every American citizen will be fired up, ready to stand up for what they believe in. Folks who have spent their lives on the sidelines or in the stands will be propelled from their seats by you. All you have to do is invite them. And it isn't just because they feel compelled to do something. It's also because they want to be on the side of hope and possibility. And so they will look to those who are leading, and they will see you. And they will want to play for your team that advocates and educates, your team that works to protect our planet and the living creatures who are our neighbors, your team that brings beauty through music and the arts, or reminds us of our history and the shoulders we stand on. I am driven to help you be the best leader you can be, to fuel your ability to lead well, manage well, and have the greatest possible impact, and to encourage you to take time from repairing our world to take good care of yourself. I am writing now amid the most terrifying health crisis of our time, the COVID-19 pandemic. I am watching nonprofits struggle so badly, and at the same time, I am watching them do the most heroic things. Eric Cooper, the president and CEO of the San Antonio Food Bank, saw what he never imagined possible. In 1 week, in April 2020, 10,000 cars lined up waiting for food. Many of the drivers never imagined they would ever need the services that Eric's heroic team provided. Listening as Eric Cooper became emotional on the evening news reminded me that there is such humanity in our sector, such deep empathy. And this has been, for me, one of the real treasures to see in the darkness. I have no crystal ball, but as all of us navigate our way through this crisis, one that reveals so clearly the racial, gender, ability, and class divides in our country, I am certain that nonprofit leaders will continue to need our support and continue to lead us in the direction of a truly civil society. Eric Cooper's story is one of many. You will meet a host of new characters in this new edition. In the past 3 years, I have worked with thousands of leaders whose stories affirm much of what I shared the first time around. Many of these leaders enriched my understanding of the superpowers and the kryptonite of the nonprofit leader. You will meet these characters and hear their stories throughout the book, and I hope that the stories and the lessons within them will be as much of a gift to you as they have been to me. So let's get to it, shall we? Acknowledgements. We are who we are because of the families that raised us. My mom passed away just after I submitted the manuscript for the first edition. I found a paper copy of the cover art for the book in her purse about a month later. It looked well-worn, like the cashiers at Stop and Shop had probably seen it a few times. It made me smile. If I am smart, feisty, and a bit of a dog with a bone about issues that feel important to me, it is because I am my mother's daughter. To steal a line from one of my kids, thanks for birthing me, Mom. My dad taught me the power of being a good coach. I saw him in action during years of being his right hand in Little League dugouts, and I admired him. Offering direction, support, and encouragement, he was not just a coach. He was a champion and an educator, a leader. Everyone wanted to be on his team. I was lucky. I was born into his team. Father Jim Loughran, S.J., of blessed memory, taught my first philosophy class. He challenged me to consider the value of my moral compass, my own intellectual capacity, and the power of inquiry. We are who we are because of the people who shape our thinking during our journey. Attorneys Paula Edelbrick and Suzanne Goldberg represented our family in a precedent-setting case to create a legal connection between our kids and me. These two triggered the activist in me, planting the idea in my head that it was time to get off the sidelines and onto the field. In 1985, Showtime engaged consultants Joan Goldsmith and Ken Cloak. Joan and Ken were evangelists about making teamwork a reality, not a buzzword, in workplaces. And they taught me about the power of difficult conversations. Much of my work today feels like the baton they passed on to me. Yes, this was the village that led me from a solid, happy life to a life with real purpose, leading me to the nonprofit sector and never looking back. During my tenure at GLAAD, I met activists, donors, and volunteers who inspired me to do my best for them. Lessons learned from this journey are too long to list, but special thanks to Heart Monitor Julie and the 5-star staff and board who partnered with me to build an organization to last. And I hope you are lucky enough to find someone like Karen McGee to step into a board leadership role. I can talk about the power of that partnership because I speak from experience with Karen. This book is my chance to reach more people with guidance and direction. My deepest thanks to Scott Paley of Abstract Edge for believing that I had something to say and for working tirelessly to ensure that the message reached far and wide. Without a blog and a podcast, both Scott's idea, there would be no book. The team at my small but very mighty consulting firm has changed and grown since my first addition. I am so grateful to have a team that is as driven to help the helpers as I am. To a person, my team is smart, funny, empathetic, and dedicated. Special thanks to Cindy Pereira, who runs what we jokingly call Joanlandia. "I think you should update your book, Joan," she said offhandedly one day. I think it was the next day we had a signed contract, because that is how Cindy rolls. I'm also deeply grateful to Laura Zelke, the Director of Member Experience for the Nonprofit Leadership Lab. She treats our work together as a vocation, and in this we are kindred spirits. Laura worked closely with me in identifying lab members whose stories would really bring the lessons to life. Thank you so much to Ariel Extut, my book doctor, and Jim Levine, my agent at Levine Greenberg Rostan Literary Agency. Jim was a nonprofit leader in a former life, and I could not have asked for a better advocate who really understands that nonprofits are messy. And of course, I am so grateful to my friends and colleagues at Wiley for believing in me. I am forever grateful to all my clients, members of the Leadership Lab, and the thousands of board and staff leaders who have entrusted their professional development to me and my team through the years. It is a privilege to serve you, and you are all my heroes. Full stop. Lastly, we are who we are because of the families we create. I never thought I'd be so lucky to have one, and I try never to take it for granted. I keep a small paper note in my desk drawer. It reads simply, "You have a colorful family." Amen. Thanks to my three kids, Scout, Ben, and Kit, for letting me catch you, raise you, annoy you, amuse you, and love you with all my heart. And of course, to my legal wife of 7 years and spouse for almost 40, Eileen Opetut. In 1996, she casually suggested I leave the for-profit sector and apply for a nonprofit executive director job. We had three kids under 7 and had just bought a big house, the perfect time for a new low-paying job. She saw, as she always does, what I often miss completely. I was a leader and an advocate ready for a cause. And so began a new chapter in my life, a life that turned from black and white to color the day we met, like Dorothy's arrival in Oz, complete with three munchkins. Introduction. I could have killed my development director, and I don't mean it the way you think. Julie arrived at a quarterly board meeting, but she didn't look quite right. It was hard not to notice that there was something protruding from her blouse. A heart monitor. She flew in from Los Angeles to Chicago, and I flew in from New York. We had not seen each other in a few weeks. Maybe she mentioned something about doctor's appointments, but come on. I was leading a nonprofit trying to save a portion of the world. Who has time for the health and well-being of staff? Clearly not me. I'm sure you're wondering, Julie is fine. Today, she is a clinical psychologist who no doubt helps clients contend with type A oblivious bosses who drive their employees to heart problems. Oh, also, in case you are wondering, the board meeting was a big hit. Julie and I were impressive and on our game, as we usually were. I did get a few comments at the breaks like, "Hey, how's Julie?" or, "Julie looks like the job is taking a toll on her." "No worries," I said, and went on to get an A+ on our board meeting presentation. But wow, who was I? Why did I not tell Julie to turn on her heels and take the next flight home to Los Angeles? I am not utterly clueless, I swear. I would never intentionally try to put Julie, or anyone else for that matter, in harm's way. But nonprofits can cause a person to transform into someone they don't recognize. Why? Because nonprofits are messy. It's inherent in the formula of the unique beast we call a 501c3. A plus B plus C plus a big dose of intense passion equals messy. A, a poorly paid and overworked group, staff, who B, rely on the efforts of people who get paid nothing, volunteers, and are overseen by C, another group of volunteers who get paid nothing and who are supposed to give and get lots of money. Board. All this is in the service of something that every single one of them cares passionately about. Wow. Now that is a recipe for messy. And that organization you care so deeply about can get messier still if it's not led and managed well. I learned the messy lesson the hard way. What did I know? 15 years in corporate America and then poof, I'm running a nonprofit. More on the poof part in a few. I felt ever so well equipped with my financial skills, my management skills, and my understanding of how to manage a budget and to deliver results. I had never met messy like this until the day I sat down at my desk at GLAAD, one of the largest gay rights nonprofit organizations. Or so I thought. Actually, GLAAD was large by reputation, but large was not the first word that came to mind when I saw that we had $360 in the bank. That was not at all the word that came to mind. It was bad. And I'll admit it here. I felt like a bit of a fraud, soon to be unmasked, as having neither the grit nor the skills to dig us out. There was one very bad day the first week on the job. I remember it well. I was at my computer, writing a solicitation letter to a lapsed donor, trying everything to drive cash in the door. I was pleased with the letter. I sent it to print on the serviceable printer, reviewed it, found a typo. And with that, I burst into tears. It may have been my predicament, but I think it was singularly focused. I knew we could not afford to reorder letterhead. Then there was this other day. I was in Los Angeles meeting with donors and praying they would pick up the tab when my phone rang. It was my deputy director in New York. He calmly said that it might be time to look for office space he knew we couldn't afford. There was an inch of snow on his desk when he arrived for work. Very, very messy. I'm not sure I knew what to expect when I left corporate America for this job. Not sure I did a lot of thinking. My move from the corporate world to the nonprofit world was more of a heart move than a head move. I was not unhappy in the corporate world. Hardly. I'd hit the corporate jackpot. In my first job out of college, I landed on the management team of MTV. Yes, working at MTV in the early 80s was just as cool as you can imagine. I also learned a ton. I learned about the pace, intensity, and thrill of being a part of a startup. More on that later. I learned how to innovate when I wrote the business plan for the MTV Video Music Awards. And my Harvard MBA boss bought me an HP 12C calculator, the calculator that allows people to assume you have an MBA, and taught me about budgets and balance sheets. From MTV, I moved to Showtime Networks. There, I became a very good manager of people. I became a team player. I learned what it meant to be a good corporate citizen as one of the early gay poster children when Showtime began to walk the walk on diversity. We gave money to worthy causes, and I found myself in the early 90s advocating for corporate sponsorship dollars from Showtime to gay organizations. While there, we built a new business, a now dinosaur that we called pay-per-view. And it was there that I learned about boxing. Yes, boxing. Like that thing big, sweaty guys do with gloves on in rings. I learned that people pay a lot of money to watch boxing on TV, and that if you get really good seats at the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas, the flying sweat, well, it flies, The most important gift Showtime gave me was the recognition that I had a voice. I became another kind of poster child, essentially an employee advocate for better communication and transparency from the senior leadership. This work, which included hosting a full staff 800 town meeting, was transformative. I found my voice as an advocate for the employees at Showtime. I found my wheelhouse. Now what? I had no idea. I just knew a change was in the offing. There was no aha moment for me. There was just a conversation. My now wife, but then spouse, partner, longtime companion, enter other euphemisms here, came home from work and told me that the executive director job at GLAAD was open. I casually remarked, "You know, somebody like me ought to have a job like that. We have 3 kids, I drive a minivan, and we really do have a white picket fence. That would shake up America's picture of a gay rights activist, huh?" Eileen, who knows how to shake things up in just the right way, casually responded to my casual remark. "Well, then somebody like you should apply." I never in a million years thought they would hire me. I had no nonprofit experience, and I had never asked a soul for money before. So they hired somebody like me, a lot like me. So me, it was me. As my good friend Amy says, "Well, slap my fanny." I guess I should have asked more questions before I took the job. That said, it probably would not have mattered. The board didn't know either. The GLAAD brand may have been big, but the problems were way bigger. I impressed myself with a tough salary negotiation that proved meaningless because all they could afford to pay me was $360, but just a one-time payment. That was the sum total in the GLAAD bank account. How did I manage? Well, nobody handed me a book, that's for sure. I don't even remember anyone telling me that everything was going to be okay. It was my job to tell everyone else that everything was going to be okay. There was so much I didn't know. Like everything, it seemed. I wish there had been a book. One with practical advice about how to untangle this mess, written by someone who had stood in my shoes, written by someone who would be my advocate, help me realize that I was not alone, and maybe even make me laugh that I was sobbing over a piece of stationery. So I decided to write the book I wish someone had handed me. Because my experience as a nonprofit leader and then as a board member and major donor and today as the principal in a nonprofit consulting practice has taught me a great deal that I believe will help you as a nonprofit leader become more effective at your job and remind you of the joy you can find in being underpaid and overworked to save even the smallest part of the world. Maybe you are wondering how I untangled the knots at GLAAD without a book. We did indeed dig out. I left the organization 8 years later with a $1.5 million cash reserve, an $8 million budget, and a staff of over 40. But that's not what counts. We made an impact. Long before marriage equality, GLAAD put same-sex couples on the wedding pages of every major newspaper in America, starting with the New York Times. If you think there are too many gay characters on television, give it to me right between the eyes. Our work at GLAAD brought us there. If the name Matthew Shepard, the young gay man murdered in Wyoming in 1998, is familiar to you, it's because GLAAD shaped that into a national story, ensuring that any discussion about hate crimes be expanded to include sexual orientation, a lasting legacy for a young man from Laramie. How did we do it? The recipe is not unique to my leadership or to GLAAD. There are universal constants. Between my own personal experience and working with hundreds of board and nonprofit staff leaders, these constants are critical to either digging out, stabilizing, or taking your organization to a place of even greater impact. You need to rely on the strength.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?